Welcome to BioCentury This Week, the podcast with BioCentury's editorial team. I'm Jeff Cranmer. We're here to talk biopharma. I am executive editor of BioCentury, and joining me today are my colleagues.
Simone Fishburn, editor-in-chief.
Steve Usden, Washington editor.
Lauren Martz, executive director of Biopharma Intelligence.
On today's podcast, John Crowley's vision for bio, the latest on the anti-China biotech bills, Madrigal's MASH drug is approved. Now it's time to build the market for this liver disease therapy. And FDA's ODAC backs BCMA CAR-Ts from Bristol-Myers and J&J and puts rapid manufacturing back in the spotlight. Okay, Steve, we have a new CEO of the biotech trade group Bio. He is the former head of rare disease company Amicus, John Crowley, and he takes over the organization at a time of extreme pressure in Washington against China CDMOs and genomics companies. We'll have more on that in a minute. And at a time when drug developers are in the spotlight for drug pricing in an election year. Steve, you've spoken to John a bunch of times recently, and last week you sort of formally talked about his vision for what's next for the trade group. Tell us about it.
You know, John Crowley had 3 months from the time he accepted the position to when he started to think about what he wants to do as bio president and CEO, and actually has had much longer because he was slated to become bio's next chair. So he had a lot of time to think about what he wanted to do. It's a tough job. Bio's influence has diminished greatly over the last decade. He's tasked with reviving it and doing it at a time when politicians across the political spectrum have declared open season on big pharma, and they're not in a mood to distinguish between big biotech and big pharma. And they're really not too worried in many cases, unfortunately, about whether their attacks on biopharma companies also hurt patients. So John Crowley told the bio staff and the board that he has 7 priorities. I won't repeat all of them. They're in my story. I found the most interesting to be, first of all, that he says he wants to put patients at the center of everything bio does. And look, everybody says this, but he had very concrete ideas about how to make it real, you know, starting from tangible things like, you know, hanging portraits of patients on the walls of bio's headquarters and bringing patients into bio to speak with the staff, and also bringing patients along to meet with members of Congress. Another thing that he talked about was breaking down barriers to access to medicines. That's obviously critical for a lot of reasons. And another thing he talked about was focusing on storytelling, which is a long-term project. And to me, it's a way to organize bio's communications, which is really important to changing public perceptions and political realities around biotech. And so he talked about doing a much better job of telling stories of patients who have benefited from biomember companies' products, those who are desperate need of biomedical innovations that haven't happened yet, and the stories of biotech entrepreneurs who have succeeded despite the odds and those who haven't. I think that's really important because if you stop the average person on the street and you ask them to name 10 entrepreneurs who have done amazing things in this country, it'd be very unlikely, unless you're outside of the bio annual meeting, that they're going to mention people in biomedicine. But, you know, as everybody's listening to this knows, the innovations that have happened in biotech and in biomedicine over the last 10 or 20 years have been astounding and arguably much more astounding and much more important than a lot of the accomplishments of people who Americans would identify as innovators.
So, Steve, you know, BioCentury has been writing, you yourself have been writing about the trade organization Bio maybe from its very earliest days, in fact. And, you know, it's had a lot of evolution, some might say devolution, since then. And I'm sort of wondering whether you think that Bio needs, and in fact, John Crowley is addressing, to revamp itself. Is it still as relevant as it used to be? It certainly unequivocally lost the plot on the IRA, right? It's now, I know, got some sort of geopolitical and political positions that it's working out. you know, on the one hand, it's representing companies. A lot of the things you're talking about are about speaking to the public. So is this part of a sort of way to make Bio connect more with the public in order to revamp its effectiveness is probably the word I want, as a lobbying or as a trade organization?
Well, I think that's a big element of it. I also think there's a lot that Bio does and that it's been effective at over the years and is effective at that isn't immediately evident to people who don't follow it. You know, one of the things that John Crowley and I talked about is the work that Bio does with FDA. Bio is really at the head of the table for the PDUFA reauthorization negotiations. And in doing that, you know, sets the stage for a lot of the most important things that are most important to the industry. Look, if you look at, you know, Bio's member companies, what are the two most important things to them? The two most important things to the vast majority of Bio companies are the ability to raise capital and a regulatory environment that is predictable science and science-based and makes it possible for them to get their products to patients as quickly as possible. Bio does important work, especially on the regulatory side. And John Crowley's got experience. You know, he's been at a company that has endured the vicissitudes of a difficult regulatory environment. He's got a lot of ideas and thoughts about what Bio should do to facilitate the development of drugs for orphan diseases. And a lot of those also cut across the whole spectrum of diseases because the issues around the need for more scientific consensus about endpoints, for consistency across the agency, for more scientific rigor and expertise at FDA, those things are relevant regardless of the indication. So yeah, I think that you're right. Yeah, he's trying to try to elevate Bio's stature and its reputation, really the reputation of the biotech industry and the pharma industry need a great deal of work. And I think that he's also, though, got his eye on a lot of these other kinds of issues that aren't as much in the public eye. You know, I should say also, in one of the priorities that he mentioned was considering biotechnology as a national security imperative. And I think he probably didn't expect that one would resonate quite as quickly as it did, but it certainly did.
So, Steve, does that getting traction, is it related to what's going on with the bill that is being championed by Representative Gallagher out of Wisconsin, related to genomics companies and CDMOs from China?
Absolutely. So the political attitude in Washington toward China, it's an issue that's front and center, and Bio has been front and center, and the biotechnology industry has been. One of the things that John Crowley did very quickly was reverse Bio's position on the BioSecure Act. He sent a letter to Mike Gallagher, and he said he had unanimous support from the executive committee of Bio's board of directors, which includes Rachel King. She was his predecessor, and she signed a letter that was sent in February opposing the bill. Bio now says it supports the BioSecure Act, and I think this makes it more likely that some version of that law will be enacted at some time. The timing's unclear, and it isn't also clear what kind of changes are going to be made. At one point, it looked like Chinese CDMOs might be excluded. I don't think that's going to happen now. More likely, projects that are ongoing at the time the legislation is enacted will be grandfathered in. But again, we don't know 100% that this is going to happen, and we certainly don't know when it's going to happen. The change in Bio's position came as a surprise. So did WuXi AppTec's departure from Bio. And John Crowley told me that having WuXi AppTec as a member of Bio presented both perceived and real conflicts of interest. And to me, that kind of highlights one of the most interesting things that I spoke with him about. He clarified something that I think has been unclear or fuzzy in some people's minds for some time. I think some people think of Bio as representing the global biotech industry. Certainly its board, even its much smaller executive committee, includes a lot of companies that are headquartered outside of the United States. Genentech, that's part of Roche, Takeda, Bayer Crop Science, Novartis, Alkermes. And Bio's annual meeting brings together companies and investors from around the world. So I kind of put it to John. I said, is Bio a representative of the global biotech industry that is based in Washington? Or is it a representative of the U.S. biotech industry that has interests internationally? What he told me is that BIO is a U.S.-based, U.S.-focused advocacy organization, and he added that it's constantly engaging internationally, knowing that this is a global ecosystem. I think that's really interesting, and I think that that provided a level of clarity about what people should think and expect from BIO going forward.
All right, thanks for that update, Steve. Steve's stories on both topics, of course, up on biocentury.com. And now a short break before we come back and talk about a couple of big regulatory events that took place last week.
For more than 20 years, Bioequity Europe has been where CEOs and investors gather to network, partner, and debate critical issues facing the biotech industry. In 2024, Bioequity heads to San Sebastian, Spain, in Basque Country, May 12 to 14th. Join BioCentury, EBD Group, and Regional Host Committee Chair, ICEOS Capital, in one of the world's culinary capitals. Don't wait, last year's Bioequity conference sold out. Visit bioequityeurope.com for more information.
All right, we're back. FDA approval of a MASH drug from the biotech Madrigal is a landmark moment for liver disease. It brings to market a THR beta agonist that aims to reverse a condition long considered irreversible, at least without a transplant. Lauren, you've been following this. I'm curious, what challenges will Madrigal face post-approval as they try to bring this drug to patients?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I do think this is a huge win for MASH patients and for Madrigal. Companies have been trying to do this, to get a drug approved for this indication for a very long time. But I do think there may be unappreciated challenges to being first to an indication like MASH. There's a very big patient population. You know, there's certainly a lot of commercial potential here. But for many MASH patients, this isn't necessarily a very symptomatic disease, especially before patients get to the point of cirrhosis. And this drug is approved for patients with the F2 and F3 stages of MASH, which are used to measure the level of fibrosis that occurs in the liver. So this is before patients progress to that cirrhosis stage. And with an indication like this, I think physician and patient education will be very important. And I think, you know, obviously this is something that the company has thought about. They're taking this to market by targeting specialists who are treating MASH patients, which is a subset of people with this condition.
Lauren, let's just take a step back, because as you pointed out, it's been a very, very long road to get something approved in MASH. You've talked about some of the first mover kind of, I don't know if I want to say penalties, but challenges that the first mover has to overcome. Are there other therapies that are hot on the heels? Are they all going to have the same kind of issues? Or is this something that's unique to Madrigal's?
Well, I think the work that Madrigal does here, both with the physicians and likely with the payers as well, you know, this is something that does not exist in the budget for most plans, because there has been no drug for MASH on the market. So any work that Madrigal does here, you have to assume is going to help pave the way for future companies to come. It's, you know, I think you can kind of think about it the way you would think about a blood pressure lowering medication. This is an important therapy. We know that if patients take these drugs, they reduce their risks of cardiovascular complications and events later. And the same will likely be true of therapies for MASH. You know, if you take these drugs, you're unlikely or less likely to experience liver failure and other complications in the future. So, yeah, I think Madrigal is probably up against the biggest challenge initially. And there are several therapies that are in the clinic and in phase three with different mechanisms. And some of these appear to possibly reduce fibrosis even better than what we've seen with Madrigal's therapy.
Seems like everything that can be treated by the anti-obesity drugs, is this another one that's also going to be on their label someday?
So what we've seen so far, we do have data. I think it's all in phase two from semaglutide and tirzepatide, at least, that are showing that these are certainly capable of helping to address MASH. So far, it seems as though what those therapies are doing is what you'd expect them to do. They're reducing the liver fat and the inflammation that happens in the liver. What we don't have evidence of yet is those types of anti-obesity drugs eliminating or reducing the fibrosis that has already happened in the liver. So I think that will be an important mechanism, an important endpoint for any MASH therapy that comes in the future, is how much you can actually reduce that fibrosis, because it's possible that the GLP-1s and those types of mechanisms may not actually address the fibrosis that has already happened. But of course, the more patients that are on an anti-obesity medicine, the fewer patients hopefully that will go on to develop MASH and liver complications.
Lauren, just a quick question. I mean, obviously showing prevention is always very hard, but are there any downsides? What are the sort of adverse profiles of these drugs?
I think these are drugs have been very well tolerated, and that's not a major barrier at this time.
Lauren, another topic you were watching closely last week was that of the BCMA-directed CAR T-cell therapies, which were up for discussion during an FDA advisory committee meeting on Friday. One drug from Bristol Myers Squibb and another from J&J and Legend. The two drugs earned the backing of FDA's Oncologic Drugs Advisory Committee in earlier lines of treatment for multiple myeloma. You tuned into the ODAC meeting, which was held Friday, Lauren. What was behind ODAC's decision to back the therapies in earlier lines of treatment?
Yeah, so I don't think there was any question that these CAR T-cell therapies directed against BCMA are incredibly effective in fourth line, fifth line, and also in second and third line. That wasn't really the issue here. The issue was during the first few months after treatment with both of these BCMA CAR T's in the clinical trials that are supporting these sBLAs, there was a higher risk of death than in the standard of care arms. So the question here was whether or not the long-term benefits are worth the short-term upfront risks. And what became clear during the meeting on Friday was that at least a large part of this upfront risk is due to the fact that patients are facing relatively significant delay from the time that they're randomized to get the CAR T-cell therapy to the time that they're actually infused with the CAR T-cells. So patients at the time of the enrollment in this trial have active multiple myeloma, often progressive disease, and the disease is progressing while patients are waiting for their therapy to be manufactured. It raised two issues, the two potential solutions. The first is innovation in the way patients are bridged during that period, what they're treated with to control the progression while they're waiting to get a BCMA-directed CAR T-cell therapy.
Lauren, you recently wrote really interesting pieces on advances in rapid manufacturing for CAR T-cell technologies. Where do those technologies fit into this paradigm?
Yeah, I think that there are two possible solutions to this problem of a long delay from when patients are first scheduled to get a CAR T-cell therapy from when they're actually treated. And the first would be making the bridging therapy more effective. And that's kind of a short-term solution, finding a way to get a better treatment to patients while they're waiting. That's challenging because the treatments that are often used in those cases have side effects, which can further delay the infusion of a CAR T-cell therapy. And that's been the big issue with bridging therapy in general. The other solution is longer term, and that would be cutting down this time that patients are waiting. And, you know, certainly rapid manufacturing is the likely way to do that.
Well, thanks for that, Lauren. Lauren's stories on the BCMA therapies and their journey to ODAC, as well as Madrigal and the challenges and opportunities for its MASH drug, are up on biocentury.com. And coming soon on biocentury.com, treating obesity by targeting inflammation in the brain, our colleague Stephen Hansen. takes a look at how NLRP3 inhibitors could extend durability and enhance cardiovascular benefits over GLP-1 therapies alone. And Simone in conversation with Atlas Ventures Bruce Booth on the BioCentury show. The 30-minute conversation will be available Thursday on our website and on BioCentury's YouTube channel. Thanks for tuning in. We will catch you next week. Kendall Square Orchestra provides the music for BioCentury this week. The group connects science and technology professionals and other members of the greater Boston community to collaborate, innovate, and inspire through music while supporting causes related to healthcare and education.